on this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
And that's what happens when you try to fit these profound, incredible substances into the typical medical models. The typical medical model is you're here for an hour, you pay for the hour, and then you leave. Whereas what psychedelics are introducing is it's a model of care, it's a model of support, it's a model of love. So all of these substances, when they're used, need to be done in a set and setting, in a container that supports and nourishes the individual as they're moving through this. This idea of the third wave is this is the time where we can perfect how we utilize these substances.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show. Hey, what's up? It's Ben Greenfield. I can't wait for you to get a hold of and listen to today's episode with Paul Austin. Paul Austin is kind of a pioneer in the psychedelic space, and he came up to my home to do a big podcast on microdosing and psychedelics and plant medicine, and that's what we're going to delve into today. So Paul's been around the scene for a while, you know, starting at 21 years old and in Michigan. He traveled all over the world, like 60 plus different countries over a span of like half a dozen years, kind of studying everything from plant medicine, again, the psychedelics to microdosing. He has a very comprehensive website called Third Wave, where he logs really good information about all of this. And we're going to dive into all of that on today's show. So I hope you enjoy. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. I get laughed at maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their sexual performance booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine in your hemoglobin increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
Dude, Paul, how'd you like that carrot cake smoothie?
Yeah. Delicious.
Yeah. That's actually shameless plug. That's actually a recipe in my cookbook.
Is it?
That launches.
Well, now I have to get the cookbook.
It launches on Monday, actually, at the time that we're recording this. So that carrot cake smoothie, I use. So I kind of cheated. Like, I used to like actually use actual carrots, but I had some of that farmer's juice, carrot juice in the fridge. So I use their like fresh pressed carrot juice. And then I use nutmeg and cinnamon and sea salt and vanilla stevia, or like all the things you'd normally use to kind of like spice up a carrot cake a little bit. And all that goes in the blender. The carrot juice goes in the blender. A shit ton of ice, because as you taste, I like it like super, super thick. Mm-hmm. You know,
like a bowl with a spatula.
Sometimes you get to the bottom, it's a little melty, liquidy, and then you drink it. And then what else was in there? A little bit of collagen, mm-hmm. a little bit of creatine, which I like creatine too, because there's some recent research that came out. You know, we always know creatine is good for strength and power and muscle building and yada, 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 and mental function. But then this recent study came out that also showed it really helps you when you are in a sleep deprived state or when you just want to operate as though you've had a full 8 hours of sleep. And sometimes you're like, this morning I got up super early. And so the two things that help you when you're in a sleep deprived state are creatine and NAD. Right. So I took some NAD this morning and put some creatine in the smoothie, and then put a little bit of almond butter in there, about two heaping teaspoons of almond butter. This was enough for two people. Kind of careful with the omega-6 fatty acids, but you got to get a little bit of almond butter smoothness in there. And then I'm trying to think what else was in there. A little bit of beet powder, just to give it a little bit of extra kick, vasodilatory effect.
I tasted that beet powder.
Yeah, make a super smart sounding for today's show. And then blend it. I blend it for like 2 or 3 minutes because I like to just get it so my biceps get a workout, because I use a little stir stick like you saw me with that blender. I go through a blender like every 4 months, just smoke them out. and then the toppings are the key. You got to get the right toppings. So for the carrot cake smoothie, what do you do is you put it in the bowls, right? Then you go unsweetened coconut flakes that I keep in the freezer because I like them kind of cold and crunchy. Mm-hmm. We did a few little chunks of like a dark chocolate. That was the Lily's Stevia dark chocolate. I also keep that cold. Some people freak out because they say cacao loses its flavor when you keep it cold, kind of like wine. But I actually like, not only do I like my red wine a little chilled, I like my chocolate a little chilled. and then my friend and your new friend, Dr. Patrick Love from the Wellness Tree in Spokane, was over at our house last night for a little party that we threw. And he made us like a keto chocolate pie. But the bottom of the keto chocolate pie was all of his like gluten-free graham cracker crust. So we broke little chunks of that graham cracker crust off. And you know, if we hadn't had that, I would use like a paleo granola or something like that. Cause basically you're taking what the crust would normally be on the carrot cake or the, not really the crust, but like the filler of the carrot cake. And you're sprinkling that on top of the smoothie. And then we manja.
It's pretty good. You did some email. Yeah. I read a book. Mm-hmm. And now we're here at the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, by the way, I'll apologize in advance for those of you listening in. because Paul and I might rocket ship to the moon in terms of our intellectualization of today's show, because Paul's rocking the Apollo, mm-hmm. right? So the Apollo is on you. What mode did we put that in?
Social and open, 50%.
Social and open, 50%. Yeah. I always jack it up to 100%. Yeah, so social and open. David Rabin, who I interviewed on this show about mm-hmm. the Apollo, he said that he thinks that most closely mimics MDMA. Mm-hmm. So kind of like, well, social and open, as the name implies. I would say maybe a little bit of like a cocktail-esque effect, like an alcohol effect, but you know, it makes you more open. Mm-hmm. And then what I am sitting on underneath my butt right now, because I'll bring it up to the mic and you guys will hear it, because I can't wear it on my head. You'll hear like a little, that like staticky sound. And so I'm using the HAPB, which is the one that uses more of a magnetic signal. The Apollo is more of a sound signal. The HAPB mm-hmm. is a magnetic signal. And I have that one set on focus, which is a nicotine. So mm-hmm. it's simulating the effects of nicotine, like the wakefulness effects of nicotine.
And we also have nicotine gum.
And we also were chewing nicotine gum.
So this
earlier.
Is just going to be...
And we punished a really good workout today.
We did.
On rounds. We did...
And a cold plunge.
Yeah, we did one person's on the Airdyne for 4 minutes, all nasal breathing at maximum sustainable pace. Well, the other person for those 4 minutes does 15 burpees, 10 kettlebell swings, and 5 kettlebell goblet squats for as many rounds as they can do while the other person jamming for 4 minutes on the bike. Then you switch. And so we did 32 minutes of that. It's like 4 rounds each of that. Hit the cold pool, had the carrot cake smoothie. Now we're here. Now we're ready. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So for those of you wondering who Paul is, I'm going to put all the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Paul Austin. In a nutshell, there's probably one website that I think is probably the best website out there in terms of just a massive collection of audio podcasts, articles, and all the way down to, we'll talk about this later, like books and coaching certifications, all related to psychedelics, plant medicine, microdosing, but almost like, you know, you have like the full guide to microdosing with LSD, the full guide to, you know, journeying with psilocybin, just like any molecule that you'd ever want, as opposed to you know, any of these forums that a lot of people will go to, mm-hmm. like Reddit or Arrowhead,
or Blue Light,
where people are just like, you know, so-called psychonauts are sharing what they experience or what kind of stacks they found to be useful. Like your website is more written from like a professional content standpoint, where it's I would say the best way I can describe it is it's a little bit more trustworthy in mm-hmm. terms of not just, you know, it'd be like going to the library and getting a book on periodization for muscle gain mm-hmm. versus going to a bodybuilding forum, mm-hmm. right? Your website's kind of more like the book that's actually got the vetted information in there. So I appreciate that. And I think that was how I originally found you, was just finding some good articles on Third Wave. And then I started following your feed. Mm-hmm. I forget how you and I actually wound up connecting in person.
Podcast. I interviewed you for the podcast.
Yeah, you interviewed
me. 2017
yeah.
or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's called
Third Waves.
Yeah, the Third Wave podcast. And I want to hear more about your story. So rather than laying out some extensive bio, I actually want to hear your bio in your words. But I would be remiss not to ask you before we jump in, what mm-hmm. what does Third Wave stand for? Like, why Third Wave?
Yeah, so First Wave was the indigenous use for thousands of years, right? Like Amazon. Ayahuasca in the Amazon, the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece, Soma in ancient India, right? So there's this long historical context of humans and plant medicine. So that was really the first wave of psychedelics. And then the second wave of psychedelics was the 50s and 60s, you know, when LSD was invented in 1938. And then psilocybin came on the scene soon after that when Gordon Wasson published on the front page of Life magazine. And then, of course, we had Leary and Richard Alpert and Ken Kesey and, you know, that whole second wave that really burst onto the scene in the 50s and 60s. And we as a culture are like, LSD? Psychedelics, what is this? And mm-hmm. so there was the backlash and, you know, the war on drugs that came after that and the Nixon administration. And so the third wave is really the integration of those two.
Okay.
How do we combine the wisdom, knowledge of thousands of years of use throughout humanity with cutting edge science about specific use cases in, you know, 2021 for how this can be applied? And what is the integration of those two to ensure that these become responsibly integrated so we don't have a similar backlash as the second wave?
Why was there a backlash? Like, and I ask that because I guess I ask it because I've heard that, like, the like the whole, let's say, like 60s Flower Child, what was the big, not the conference, but it was like the Burning Man type of thing that they had back in the 60s.
The Acid, you know, Test, the
big festival. What was the name of the festival?
Woodstock.
Yeah, Woodstock. Like that whole crowd was potentially posing a problematic issue for the U.S. government because it was a bunch of people who were almost like sticking it to the man or defying authoritarianism or could potentially not be sheeple because they were woke due to their use of plant medicine. Is there something to that, or were there other reasons that the second wave kind of got shut down or that plant medicine in general was vilified during that time?
Well, there's a few intersecting threads there, right? The first thing is it was the counterculture. It was the other, right? So they sort of position themselves as, we are opposite to the mainstream. And so whenever you position yourself as the other, as opposite, then there's naturally going to be like a fight in that. So I think that's sort of the foundation of it, is we are the counterculture. And then the counterculture was associated with the Vietnam War, right? So all the protests that were going on against the Vietnam War, the left, you know, being like, we shouldn't be in Vietnam, we shouldn't be doing this, right? That was all associated with it too. And then of course all the stuff that was happening in the 60s around race riots and, you know, all that sort of stuff just made it like, you know, the John Ehrlichman, who was in the Nixon administration, basically said in the mid-90s, hey, we couldn't make being a hippie illegal, we couldn't make being black illegal, but we can make the drugs that people were using illegal. So we can make LSD illegal, and we can make heroin illegal, which is what the black people were using. And so this sort of kicked off the war on drugs. So I think that was like core to it. And then, I mean, if I get a little bit more meta, you know, for hundreds of years, the core drugs that were used in Western civilization and in our industrial culture were nicotine, tobacco, and alcohol. So anything that wasn't within that paradigm, nicotine, tobacco, and alcohol, cannabis, psychedelics, whatever else it is, it posed a threat to the sort of dominant culture and the dominant kind of mainstream way of being. And so since it was the other, you know, the Nixon administration was like, we can't have this anymore. We can't have people waking up and realizing that they are God, or they are part of this universal consciousness. We want to kind of keep it.
Right. Cause that's kind of like the collective experience that a lot of people have, not necessarily when they microdose, although many microdosing protocols, like I've used, for example, you know, like Wachuma or San Pedro or something like that, when microdose, it actually does make you more social and open and communicative, and it's great for a date night or a party or a time when you just want to be more open with other people, almost like, well, in a way, loving others more, right? And same thing with a microdose of psilocybin, for example. I've found myself to be more open, more honest, more transparent during discussions. But when you do these deeper dives, these deeper journeys, you wind up having this, you know, it's almost in the same way that we were talking about in the sauna last night, how people who will use DMT often tend to see, you know, whatever, purple fairy or praying mantis, and it's not as though it's something that is unique to that individual. Like a whole bunch of other people experience the same thing. Mm-hmm. Seems like almost everybody will do like ayahuasca or psilocybin or something like that, come back out of it thinking more of humans as like this collective race that's here to care for the planet and care for each other and love each other. And it's totally antithetical to like an authoritarian regime or a country that might be trying to dominate other countries. It's more, you know, almost similar again to that book we were talking about, like Charles Eisenstein last night, The Sacred Economy, and how money needs to be reinvented to be based on, you know, gifts and mediums of exchanges based around gratitude and caring for the planet, etc. But it is, if you think about it, back to the second wave, like a very hippie-esque type of psyche. Mm-hmm. That you tend to create through these type of experiences, that you could see, you know, a government that wanted to dominate, or someone who wanted people to just line up in a row and do what they were told, mm-hmm. might actually be a little bit fearful of in terms of that becoming like a popularly used drug.
And this, I mean, we track this back. There was this book published, The Immortality Key, by Brian.
Yeah, Brian Marasco. Right? Yeah.
And so he talked about how, you know, when the ancient Roman Empire needed to basically create a political system that could be widespread. They also cut out plant medicine and made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire in like AD 307 or something. So for hundreds of years before that, the Greeks and the Romans were doing these private ceremonies with plant medicine, especially as part of early Christianity as this cult.
Right.
And then once it was like, okay, we really want this to be sort of mainstream. We can't have everyone thinking that they have this Gnostic connection to God. We need to keep it within the priestly class, if you will, they cut down on it. So it also has something to do with
meaning that plant medicines would be limited to the priests, to like the inner circle of a religion and not to the masses,
right?
That type of thing.
Precisely.
Like the Eucharist, for example, the taking of bread and wine as part of communion. I believe that Brian's argument was that the wine wasn't just wine. It was spiced and infused with the type of things that would allow for, say, deeper connection to God or opening of the third eye or the ability to be able to, maybe not in a fully Gnostic sense in terms of total disconnection from the physical body, but definitely being able to use those type of substances to get into an altered state of consciousness that would allow for more meaningful, you know, prayer or meditation or scripture or connection to God. Mm-hmm. Like that was all eliminated basically to just be something that the authorities had access to.
Or even, and then at some point that no one had access to.
So then it was marked as like a sin or forbidden that nobody had access to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the ancient Greeks, what they said with these Eleusinian mysteries is that life would not be worth living without Kaikion, which was the ancient beverage that they drank, the thing that was infused with ergot, which is the same thing that LSD is made from. So they knew how central this was to feeling like life was worth living, to feel like there was purpose and meaning, to feel like there was a connection to something greater. And so for 1700 years, you know, since 300 AD, we've been kind of like, it's always been in the underground and hasn't been fully accessible. And that's why what's happening now in 2021 with the medicalization of psychedelics, with Oregon legalizing psilocybin therapy, with Decrim happening, this is like a massive experiment about what would it look like to have psychedelics once again in kind of the mainstream, available and accessible to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And this is why in my own sort of thread, when I started Third Wave in 2015, almost 6 years ago now, I focused predominantly on microdosing as that public entry point, because frankly, these high dose experiences are very disorienting. Mm-hmm. And so not everyone can actually hold that space to have that connection. And yet these substances are really profoundly useful. Yeah.
Well, isn't that traditionally the way that a heftier use of a substance like this was viewed, is that certain people who were called or qualified or in or able to, I guess, almost like handle that type of dose responsibly, were the people that would use it and then come back to the rest of humankind or their community with what it is they'd experienced, what they'd learned, shared that with everyone else, but that it wasn't necessarily something everyone used as much as what select individuals who had the responsibility and the proper care and training to be able to use would use and then come back and share what they'd experienced with others, almost like an oracle.
Right. So in the Eleusinian mysteries, right, the ancient Greek mysteries, they would do it once in their lifetime, right? Plato and Aristotle and all these major thinkers of Greek civilization would go, they would experience this and they would have that experience, but they could actually never talk about it. Mm. If you talked about the actual experience when you came back from it, you would be excommunicated.
Could you talk about what you learned?
Talk about what you learned, what you kind of like. So there's a philosopher, Peter Schoestedt Hughes, who talks about how Plato's core philosophy about non-duality was informed by psychedelic use.
Right.
So that was like the bedrock of all of Western philosophy, right? We say everything is a footnote to Plato. And he was informed through that by this psychedelic experience. So he could talk about, right? People would come back and go, these are the insights that I have, but they could never talk about, this is what actually happened at the Eleusinian mystery.
Okay. So in terms of like, this is what I used, this is what the dosage was.
This is what the ceremony was like, this is a closely held secret. It was all secret.
Yeah.
It was all a mystery, and that was a huge part of it. And that's, I think, when we come back in today's day and age, this is the value that psychedelics bring to people, is they help them get back in touch with the mystery.
right,
or source or God or whatever it is. And so much of us, we kind of have this deep soul longing for faith and for what is the unknown,
right,
because of, you know, the scientific method and because of, you know, tech and because of, you know, we feel like we have all the answers. And when we think we have all the answers, that's what often creates suffering, because we don't have that ability to expand and really trust in this greater power that's watching over us and taking
care of us. Right. And that is basically scientific, logical rationalism would be, or scientism is this idea that everything must be stripped down to its explainable parts.
Right.
And at the end of the day, we find the ultimate source of where everything came from, the quark, or what's smaller than the quark, or what's smaller than that. And anybody who has, for example, or at least in my own experience and people I've talked to who have, for example, you know, journeyed with something like DMT, you kind of experience that. Like you can see like individual particles and sound waves, and you're digging. And, you know, for me personally, I got to the point where I could almost like strip apart a tree down to its individual constituents and see every last component of it. And then at the very, very, very end, when I was like, oh wow, this is like, I'm about to see the source where everything came from. Then it was just like, boom, blinding light, nothing. And you realize coming out of that experience, you know, for me personally, I already, based on my faith, my Christian upbringing, have a strong belief in God, have no doubt that God exists, and have no doubt that God is the source of the universe. And so for me, it was more verification, or almost like a more beautiful understanding of that. Mm-hmm. But for many people, you know, and even my own, you know, facilitator who I've worked with for plant medicine, you know, says that when he works with people, he's like, I've had many, many atheists come to my facility and none leave. He's like, just because you realize, oh, like there is at the end of the day, this unexplainable source, this unexplainable beginning that everything was founded from. And that's where this clashes with science, because it can't be explained. And when somebody goes down that road and has that realization, you know, it stands in stark contrast to a lot of what you were just alluding to, that idea that everything must be explainable, when in fact, you know, it's not. And so Jamie Wheel is another author, in addition to Paul, who you brought up. He just wrote a book called Recapture the Rapture. And he talks about how human beings basically have these elements, these sacred elements woven into culture, you know, for eons of time. And it really is the things that are nowadays vilified in a sense, right? It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Right, which is in a way the sacred sexuality of two human beings being intertwined in a way that's nearly unexplainable in terms of the connectivity that occurs there on a deep spiritual level, right? Which has now been just like bastardized with porn and polyamory and cheapening of sex and prostitution and all the things that destroy that. Drugs, which are in fact these amazing molecules that you and I are talking about right now that can be used for great good and for personal insight and even productivity and creativity, also vilified because of misuse or because of misinterpretation. And then rock and roll, right? What music, when combined with sex and drugs used responsibly, I mean, like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and people joining together and engaging around that for good, not for evil, not in a vice sense of those terms. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a magical combination, and it's just something that I think scientific rationalism has driven us away from. And, you know, I don't know what you think about this, Paul, but you know, Jamie talks about this a little bit in his book, in that, you know, human beings crave that type of spiritual connection so much that like agrarian economies were built around the concept of like the agriculture being there for the fermentation capability of grains, so that people could enter into altered states of consciousness and basically engage in things like the connection with God, like seeking that deep abyss in our hole, that eternal soul, or that eternal hole that wants to be filled by God, and the use of these substances to allow one to get closer to that state. Like if you step back and look at it, humans actually are really, really hardwired, once we fulfilled Maslow's hierarchy of needs, to enter into that state using things like sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
And then it can get too out of control, right? That's what happened in the 60s, right? We had the acid test of the Grateful Dead and Ken Kesey and, you know, the Merry Pranksters, who were just dosing everyone on acid out in the West. And then we had Woodstock. And so when you bring all those things together, it's almost like that's why the Greeks had this secret container for it, because that way it kept contained
right.
in this thing, and it didn't sort of interrupt the normal everyday
right.
flow. But once that comes up and interrupts the normal everyday flow, that's where we go, okay, we need to lock down on this, because it's just it's bringing up too much, it's exposing too much, there's too much chaos, right?
Yeah.
So even if we talk about, like Jordan Peterson talks about this, right? That balance between chaos and order. And in the 60s, it just got way too chaotic. And so we had to bring the order back down. And so that's why now in today's day and age, MAPS in particular has focused so much on the medicalization of psychedelics.
The multidisciplinary association
for psychedelic yeah. studies. They're bringing MDMA through phase 3 trials for PTSD. They've raised tens of millions of dollars as a nonprofit to make that happen. And the reason that's so critical is because through that clinical trial kind of methodology, that is the order through which we're holding the natural chaos that comes from these substances.
Right. It's like the MK Ultra experiments, you know, done mm-hmm. on the CIA operatives, where they, you know, I think in a nutshell, they would put them on LSD and were they basically trying to get information that normally you wouldn't be able to get out of a human being by shifting them into an altered state of consciousness using high doses of LSD?
Well, they were trying to see like mind control. Like, can we use right. LSD for mind control?
Right.
And so this is the dark side of psychedelic substances, is they are non-specific amplifiers and they dramatically increase suggestibility. Mm-hmm. So if you use psychedelics within sort of a shadowy dark container, then you can easily manipulate people, which is where we see the shadow elements of psychedelics. And that's why the container that we do these in needs to be so clean and pure and sacred.
Right.
Because when you're in that state, you're suggestible to whatever is coming in. You want to make sure that you are connecting to something that is divine mm-hmm. and not some sort of guru that's trying to manipulate you into doing X, Y, and Z.
Right. Well, that's one reason why something like MDMA couples therapy can be so effective, mm-hmm. because you're essentially with your partner on truth serum.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Looking deep into each other's eyes and sharing all your hopes and dreams and wishes and desires and fears and subtle annoyances that you might have with them, but in this very open space, and then the information is just flowing in full truth, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that can be effective for many couples to be in that space together, be in that altered state of consciousness together. And then, you know, when I was thinking about the MK Ultra experiments and how this ties into this idea of the oracle. Right. So if you watch, let's say like the movie 300, right, where King Leonidas is climbing up the rock and he gets to those oracles at the top, and then they have, you know, they're on some kind of a substance and they are getting information about whether or not he should go to battle, you know, from an oracle that they've consulted. You know, if you look at some of these medicines, because I've certainly been given the privilege of partaking in some different combinations of plant medicines that almost turn your brain into a 20x supercomputer. So not hallucinogens, but what would be called clairogenic substances, mm-hmm. right? Where you are experiencing hyper creativity, hyper productivity, and literally seeing things years down the line that you should or could be doing from a business standpoint or a personal standpoint or relationship standpoint, and mapping out in a very productive way, like years forward of your life. Like, you know, that's actually been a big game changer for me in terms of my own personal and business success, is the use of those type of components. Cause you'll see things like, oh, by this date at this time, these are the 6 chapters of the book that you need to have mapped out. And this is everything that needs to be included in them. Like, just crazy stuff. But you could also see that being manipulated, right? What if the government, or let's say, you know, the CIA were to hook like 20 people up, turn their brains into supercomputers and literally trap them in a room Matrix style and try to harness a bunch of information that they could use, you know, for planning world domination or something like that. Like there's all sorts of ways that this could go wrong, right?
Right, right. And so that's why like these are tools, right? Tools can be bad or tools can be good. And so the orientation of everything that we're using them for is to help people connect to divinity, connect to themselves, and then integrate that experience so they can show up as better partners, so they can show up with more vision and inspiration for their teams, so they can, you know, a lot of it's healing depression, healing addiction, healing alcoholism. There's so many, you know, it's a broad use case. And we want to ensure that it goes well this time, right? So that's the whole idea of this third wave of psychedelics, right? We'd had the first wave for thousands of years. We tried it with the second wave. And the number of three, right? And the number of three is perfection. This is where the Trinity comes from. So this idea of the third wave is this is the time where we can sort of perfect how we utilize these substances, or what I call the skill of psychedelics, to ensure that we use these responsibly, to ensure that they're used for purposes that help with morality, that help us to develop values and principles, that help us to come together and create community, as Charles Eisenstein talks about in Sacred Economics, right? Using these substances to actually reconsider our core values around the meaning of being interconnected, right? Mm-hmm. Stepping out of the story of separation and reinvesting our time and energy into rebuilding the communes, into rebuilding community. Because that's so much of what our despair and suffering and disconnection is about in today's day and age.
Yep.
It's feeling disconnected. It's feeling like we're just in this sort of matrixy world and we can't step out of it. And psychedelics help us to get above that parapet, so to say, and see, oh, there's this beautiful future that we can create in the midst of a lot of existential despair at this point.
Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. I get laughed at maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use quantum energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality. Could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris, My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
You are correct also that it is difficult to be selfish or to at least develop selfish tendencies as readily when you are in a state in which you are seeing human beings as part of a collective race there for each other's good. You know, it's like, you know, in the Bible, it says the two greatest commandments are to love God and love others. And certainly for the second component of that, and I guess arguably the first component as well, it seems that many of these compounds help to shift you into that state more readily. And honestly, I think that's one of the reasons that God put them on this planet in the first place, is for that type of use, you know. And just like anything, I mean, even the book of Proverbs in the Bible, you know, it lauds the values and the virtues of honey, right? And how great honey is and how sweet it is and how wonderful it is. And then later on, it tells you, yeah, honey makes you vomit. Too much honey is going to make you, you know, sick or fat or lazy, you know. And so there's this idea of temperancy, of mastery of desires, of mastery of passions. Yet it's almost, and this is the way I describe myself as a hedonistic Christian, right? Meaning that I enjoy, well, a temperate hedonistic Christian. I enjoy all God has to offer on this planet and all that he has created. In a hedonistic sense, you know, in that, like last night, right? Like we're partying, we're in the sauna, we had a little cannabis, we hit the cold pool, we had keto chocolate pie and slow smoked pork ribs and wine, and we played music and we did some meditation, and you know, then you know,
played some bags and as then, well.
Yeah,
we 11-0 in bags.
We played some cornhole. Good. You know, and that was a very like hedonistic experience, and it was not an amoral hedonistic experience. We weren't having an orgy and sacrificing babies to some, you know, unknown god. Like we were just enjoying God's creation. And then, you know, this morning we were out there sweating out in the driveway and shivering in the cold pool. You know, and I was doing my meditation, prayer, and journaling, and all those things that you might consider to be temperancy and master of desires. You know, I was fasting for at least 12 hours after that feast last night. And I think that both can be had to a certain extent, you know, using the same type of, I guess, you know, almost like the hedonistic calendaring approach that Jamie Will talks about in a book like Recapture the Rapture. But, you know, I personally get a lot of flack for that, dude, that like for me being a Christian who also embraces with responsibility the fact that God created all for good and that you can responsibly engage with just about any of these things. And I would at the same time say that like heftier doses of some of these substances, it's not for some people. Like I do agree with the idea that some are called and some are not, some are chosen and some are not, not to sound haughty or narcissistic, but some people from either a genetic standpoint or a serotonin standpoint or where they're at in life in terms of responsibility and addictive potential, I think this stuff can be dangerous for a lot of people. And then I think there are others who can engage with these substances and then come back and share some really good shit with the rest of the world that they've discovered through their use of such compounds.
Yeah, and some people are in the archetype where they're really in that sort of orderly phase, that orderly sense. And so to throw something in, like a huge dose of a psychedelic will just totally interrupt that. And it's not, that's not necessarily for them. And yet those people can benefit from, for example, microdosing, right? And you and I have both done microdosing extensively. So even doing something like microdosing, if you're not going into the super high doses, can still be beneficial for that. And so I think this is all about, you know, this gets back to how we as individuals develop an intuition for what is best for us, because so much of our conditioning is around, you know, whether it's diet, exercise, sleep, relationships, we're supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z. And what psychedelics help us to recognize is how much can we honor that inner intuition about what is best for us and slowly start to open that more and more and more so that we can really live in a way that's free, in a way that we feel aligned with this sort of inner truth that we have. All of these things is what psychedelics help with.
Yeah, we've had a very esoteric discussion thus far, but I want to I want to do some brass tacks too. Did you microdose with anything before our podcast?
I did not. The smoothie bowl because we talked about doing it maybe later.
We're going to go play frisbee golf and do a little bit of. So I think this afternoon, for example, we'll take a little bit of psilocybin, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit of lion's mane, mm-hmm. something to open up blood flow, like beetroot or something along those lines, and then our plan is to go play frisbee golf or to hike or to paddleboard in nature. And, you know, the reason that we might use something like that prior is increased sensory perception. Colors become more vibrant. You know, sounds become more audible. Smells become better. Sometimes your visual acuity is better when you're throwing the frisbee, or the joy and the dopaminergic response to seeing that paddle enter the water and feel the rush of water past the board as it sweeps through. You know, it's not to overquote this fellow, but you know, as I think Jamie it is who says anything you can do high can do better.
Yeah.
And I in no way am saying that to enjoy life you must have substances in you, but that's an example of how you and I would responsibly use a microdose to enjoy our afternoon. Mm-hmm. Or for example, this Monday, I told you my cookbook launches this Monday. Mm-hmm. So I'll probably have like a 14-hour work day on Monday, just, you know, jamming away, replying to emails, you know, fostering the team, making sure everything goes right. So that's a case in which I would take something to really enhance productivity, mm-hmm. and focus. You know, I might do a microdose of like 10 to 20 micrograms of LSA or LSD on, mm-hmm. Monday morning. And you know, those are just a couple of examples, but for you personally, I'm curious to hear, as a guy who's kind of steeped in this, what a microdosing protocol would look like for you, if you would care to walk me through, like, let's say like a week in the life of Paul when it comes to the use of such substances.
So the way that I started microdosing was in 2015. I heard about it on the Tim Ferriss podcast. Jim Fadiman, who's been a guest on the show, he talked about it. And I had previous experience with psychedelics, like when I was 19 and 20, had high doses of LSD and psilocybin, and noticed that after those experiences, I always had that sort of afterglow effect where, mm-hmm. things just felt easier. I was more in flow. I was more connected. I was even more disciplined about meditation or diet.
Not during, but in the days after.
In the week or 2 week after, right? After having those high dose experiences. And so when I heard about microdosing and some of the benefits that people were experiencing from it, I thought back to that afterglow period and I thought, hey, microdosing seems like a really interesting tool to elongate that afterglow feeling, so that instead of it just being a week or 2 weeks, it could be a month or 2 months or 3 months, right? So the way that I first started microdosing was twice a week on LSD, anywhere from 15 to 20 micrograms, just as a way to get a feel for it, to see how it helped with. And I had two core intentions for that time. One was to help with flow and productivity, so to wake up in the morning and get into the zone on things that I was working on the business that I was building at the time, just to cut out distractions and be really in it, be more articulate, be more refined about what it is that I wanted to create. And then the second core sort of intention was around social anxiety. Mm. And just instead of using something like alcohol when I was going out and spending time with friends, I would instead microdose with LSD, in particular LSD, to help with that sense of feeling connected and feeling open, mm-hmm. and feeling like I could be vulnerable, mm-hmm. with people. And so those 7 months went phenomenally well.
And quite notably with far less toxicity.
Far less toxicity.
Far less liver damage.
There's no hangover.
Far less. Yeah, hangover. Way cleaner than, say, alcohol.
And it's not even like, it's not far less damage. It's also a ton of benefits as right? Like microdosing is anti-inflammatory. It helps with neurogenesis. It helps to increase BDNF growth. It helps with general sort of mindfulness and being able to direct attention in certain ways and places. And so now that I've been microdosing almost 6 years on and off, right, with LSD, with psilocybin, with San Pedro, with cannabis, I've tried Iboga a couple times. Typically, my microdosing way is now two or three times a week. If I'm with LSD, it's usually twice a week because LSD is more dopaminergic. Mm-hmm. So LSD typically has a bit more of a sort of manic effect, right? Mm-hmm. It can be really intense. And so only twice a week if I'm microdosing.
And also tolerance tends to build for that, mm-hmm. as well as potentially like a dopamine desensitization, mm-hmm. which is honestly why... Yeah, this is quite trendy these days. People do dopamine fast, mm-hmm. right? Where I'm just going to eat potatoes for 3 days, you know, and then food all of a sudden is way better, or I'm not going to use any substances for a couple of weeks, or watch funny movies, or do anything that really induces pleasure in a very stoic sense of the word, not in a form of masochistic self-denial for life, but in a way that allows you to kind of reset some of those dopamine receptors, the same way you might you know, quit drinking coffee for a week out of every month to keep your adenosine receptor sensitized. So, right. Yeah. So something like microdosing with LSD, you wouldn't do it like every day.
No, twice a week at the most. With microdosing psilocybin, I'll usually do it 3 times a week every other day. And then the intention is simply do it in the morning, first thing when I wake up, on an empty stomach with a probiotic or with rhodiola or with, you know, some other supplements. I usually fast in the morning, so I don't eat anything. So it's almost always on an empty stomach. And then sometimes that's on a day off. I'm going hiking. I'm spending time with friends. I'm going for a bike ride. I'm doing what we're going to do later today, which is just sort of attuning my sensitivity through sensuality and the world around me.
Right.
And then there are other days where it's like, this is a brainstorming day. This is a day to sort of, you know, have that sense of stepping back and seeing what the bigger picture might be. And this is where we get into microdosing versus mini dosing versus museum dosing. There's different ways that we can calibrate. There's different ways that we can calibrate our dose level based on our intention for the day. Because if we're wanting to have more of a flow state, right, a microdose is going to be better for that because it allows us to maintain focus and attention and stay grounded. But as you know, like the difference between, let's say, 200 milligrams of psilocybin and 500 milligrams of psilocybin is significant. Mm-hmm. When you're on 200 milligrams of psilocybin, a true microdose, it's easier to stay grounded and focused. But if you have more than that, let's say 500 milligrams of psilocybin, you tend to feel a little bit more like the 50,000 foot view, right? And so I love those dose levels for like going for a long hike, having a journaling session and being able to zoom out and go, what does the next month look like? What does the next 3 months look like? What does the next 6 months look like? Maybe the next 3 years, 5 years, depending on the dose level, getting that sense of touching, getting back in touch with a higher level vision and just sort of aligning that North Star about where is it that I'm heading personally, professionally, as the two intermingle and intertwine. And then the microdosing helps with just the day to day of doing the tasks that need to get done to sort of accomplish or reach that larger vision of what I've set out for myself.
That's a really good description. I don't think I've heard such a good description before of the subtle nuances between a small microdose and a larger microdose, because in my own experimentation, I've certainly found that to be the case, but wasn't really able to explain it the way that you just had. It's as though the larger microdose, let's say 500 milligrams of psilocybin, it's not as though you're tripping, but you do turn into wanting to engage in very big visionary tasks. And sometimes it can be disappointing if you realize you've taken too much and you're supposed to be, let's say, working on the nuts and bolts of an article, but instead you're more in a mindset where you're able to map out the idea for the next 10 articles, but not work on the one you're supposed to be working on. Whereas like a microdose, you're churning out amazingly creative sentences in that one article. I'm obviously explaining this from the perspective of someone who's a writer, right? And so that's what I've certainly experienced. But yeah, the way that you've just explained it is perfect. Like if you take a little bit too much, it's not as though it's destroyed your day, but you may have to reinvent the way that you approach that day as far as, you know, what you choose to be productive in based on big vision versus smaller tasks, smaller, more focused tasks. So, you know, another thing I wanted to ask you was, you know, you said that you've used a lot of different such substances for microdosing. You mentioned Iboga, for example, which I've also used as almost like a pre-workout, you know, like this South African bush extract that in large doses is probably one of the more
intense, if not the most intense
strips that one can engage in. What other substances have you microdosed that perhaps fly under the radar or that people may not be as aware of? Or
DMT is an interesting one.
Or stacked together.
Yeah, DMT is an interesting one. So in 2017, I was giving a talk in Bushwick in Brooklyn after a conference with Hamilton Morris and a few other, Duncan Trussell and a few other folks, and talked about microdosing DMT in that session. And then someone came up to me afterwards and was like, thanks for mentioning DMT vape pens. Here's a free vape pen. Mm-hmm. And so then for the next 3 or 4 months, every now and then I would start my morning meditation with a microdose of N-DMT, not 5-MeO. 5-MeO is the unity consciousness, the toad, that's much more intense. But N-DMT is where we see aliens and praying mantises and those sorts of things. So I would start with that. It was just a 10 to 15 minute thing, but it would whoosh, instantly align sort of all my chakras and send me into a deep, deep meditation. And then I would come out of that like really refreshed and rejuvenated.
How long would you meditate with something like that? I'm actually asking because I have an NDMT pen downstairs and I have, I just sitting down there somewhere with all my, I've freaking pantry full of stuff downstairs, yeah. but I haven't really even messed around with it. So how did you use it?
Like 20, 25, 30 minutes, you know, depending how long you want to stay in that state. It would be one or two hits that you would take with that. And then you can instantly drop into a deep meditation, combine it with the Apollo Neuro on the meditation and mindfulness setting, and then just get into that state. Like really, really quick.
Okay. I'm going to have to show you the biocharger later on because I often will meditate with the biocharger, which is light radio frequencies, Rife frequencies, and PEMF. Mm. This giant, you probably saw it downstairs when you were in the sauna room. Mm-hmm. That thing, when you meditate in front of it, I mean, you literally feel it just sweeping up and down your body. And now that you filled me on the Apollo Neuro, what I'll do is I'll try a little bit of that NDMT pen at some point next week. I'll do the Apollo Neuro, but I'll probably do it in front of the biocharger and I'll fill you in on how that goes. That's interesting. I actually really like to combine technology, you know, like the new calm, the hyperbaric chamber, breath work, the sauna, sometimes the cold pool, you know, the Apollo, the HAPB with some of these substances. And, you know, and even for example, like the massage that I get once a week, you know, I'll use, typically a little bit of ketamine, often with a little bit of THC prior to relax the body, but it's on a full sound acoustic table with pulsed electromagnetic fields under the table and typically an oil diffuser at some point around the table. So you're getting the aromatherapy. And then I've also got what's called a key underneath the table. And the key QI is designed to emit a signal, you know, very, very similar to the type of signal that you might get if you're barefoot on the planet Earth or absorbing a bunch of negative ions. So I'll stack all that stuff together. But I honestly, and I don't know about you, I kind of like the combined use of the so-called, you know, ancient technologies with the modern technologies. And I think that's something that has yet to be really heavily tapped into or systematized in the use of any of these medicines or microdosing protocols.
Well, in 2018, as one of the projects that I did, so I started Third Wave in 2015, which is the platform and the podcast and the guides and everything that you had mentioned before. But I also, in 2018, started a legal psilocybin retreat center in the Netherlands called Synthesis.
Oh, really?
And we did experiences for 750 people with psilocybin truffles because it's legal in the Netherlands. We rented out this beautiful church that was built about 100 years ago that had been renovated into a modern wellness center with attached apartments and a sauna and a beautiful ceremonial space. We would host 15 people there at a time for these high-dose experiences. And the way that I came up with that name, Synthesis, was precisely what you mentioned. How can we create an experience, a container for people where they can combine cutting edge technologies, like let's say float tanks, or let's say, you know, being in a church and that sort of thing, with these age old practices of psilocybin and breath work and meditation. And what are the synthesis of those two coming together to sort of inform this new way of being, right? And now even what Synthesis is doing is they've rolled out a medical program.
So it's still there, this retreat in the Netherlands?
Well, we put it on pause because of COVID, but we pivoted and rolled out a clinical training program where we're training 100 clinicians to be approved to have licenses in the state of Oregon to be able to do psilocybin therapy when that becomes legally feasible. So we're looking at, you know, closing on a certain place there in Oregon to host experiences and retreats, and essentially looking at how Synthesis can combine those to create even new models of clinical care, right? Where clinical care so far has been like in a psychiatric office or in a hospital or something that is not, even what your brother was talking about last night, it's just not that conducive for real healing. So
my brother Zach, he's like, yeah, I did ketamine and I didn't really get much out of the experience. So I told him my first ketamine experience was with Dr. Matthew Cook, you know, a wonderful physician who's been on this podcast multiple times down in San Jose. And it was like a 2-hour dinner with him the night before, talking about what to expect and how the entire experience went, and then going to his office in the morning and doing breath work and getting an NAD IV and cleaning out the whole body. And then you're shifted into this room with, like, you know, like special Chinese lanterns and a rug and meditation cushions and a wonderful bed to lie down in and a face mask. And then two noise blocking headphones that you put on, and then a slow ketamine infusion overseen by a nurse. And there's like a voice recorder in the room. And then after the ketamine, you're still there for another like 2 hours, just laying back. And there's a little journal beside you to write things down in. And my brother's like, yeah, I just like sat down and they just like inject me with a bunch of stuff and just like left me in this like medical room. And then I couldn't stand up that well, but then they sent me out to the parking lot because they're about to close. And I had to stand out there in the parking lot and figure out how to drive away in my car. I'm like, no, that wasn't terrible. That was not a ketamine. That was basically medical malpractice, not a ketamine experience.
And that's what happens when you try to fit these profound, incredible substances into the typical medical models. The typical medical model is you're here for an hour, you pay for the hour, and then you leave. Whereas right. what psychedelics are introducing is it's a model of care. It's a model of support. It's a model of love. So all of these substances, when they're used, need to be done in a set and setting, in a container that supports and nourishes the individual as they're moving through this. So it's a total reframing of how we're viewing healthcare, of how we're viewing psychiatry, where it's not so much of a focus on the substance itself, if you will, but it's about the preparation. It's about the container in which you're doing the substance. It's about the integration afterwards with the support of a therapist or a community, right? We really have to look at that holistic integrative picture when we're working with these substances, because so much of what they're bringing up is stuff from the subconscious and the unconscious that we just,
right.
It's not the typical biomedical model anymore that we're looking at.
Yeah. I invested in Field Trip Health, which was, they've rolled out a bunch of ketamine clinics in Canada and are also opening in New York and in LA. And they have a podcast. You can go learn more
field
about
tripping.
What mm-hmm. they do. Yeah. Field Trip.
You were on that
one. Ronan Levy. Yeah. And, you know, I really like that approach. And during COVID they had to pivot a little bit. And I think they created an app that, mm-hmm. you know, where you can actually with your own ketamine, you know, follow all the instructions in the app with special musical sequences. And you have like a coach who kind of walks you through the whole process in your home. And so I think there are ways that you can kind of combine enabling someone using technology and apps and almost like a telemedicine approach mm-hmm. along with these type of clinics. But then you were telling me last night in the sauna about another clinic. I think you said it was Entheon. And they're doing like a DMT infusion.
Intravenous.
Yeah. Tell me about that. And as you're explaining, just opening the kimono for folks, I'm going to walk over to the fridge and grab a Zevia if my voice gets faint. You want anything?
I would like okay. something to
all
drink.
All right. So fill us in on Entheon. We're listening. Go ahead.
Okay. So Entheon Biomedical is a company that's out of Vancouver, Canada, and they are looking at intravenous DMT for addiction in particular. So the CEO, Timothy Koh, who we had on Third Wave's podcast, he started it maybe about 18 months ago because he had his own DMT experiences, NN-DMT, not 5-MeO, NN-DMT, and realized that it could be a profoundly useful way to treat addiction, because unlike a psilocybin or an LSD, which can last for anywhere from 6 to 12 hours, with DMT, you can bring someone into that deep state of healing yeah. for addiction, and it might only last 20 or 30 or 40 minutes. Yeah. And if you can titrate that through an intravenous sort of constant, and then you can actually calibrate right. how deep someone goes into
so
that
much
experience.
What you can do with ketamine, you can open it up or back right. it off a little bit more if you're using intravenous instead of like oral administered. Cheers, by the way. This Cheers. Podcast brought to you by Zevia cream soda,
ginger root beer,
which I established last night, is wonderful with the mezcal tequila. And you've got ginger root beer, which is really good with like a coconut vanilla ice cream for a root beer float.
Oh my yeah. God, that is good.
Wow. Zero calories.
Zero calories.
Stevia. Brought to you by Zevia. They actually are a pretty good company. They use like a really good form of stevia. They don't mix with a bunch of maltodextrin. I had somebody analyze the cans. It's actually got like low metals and it's clean stuff. So I don't know. I'm sure someday they'll find something wrong with it, and I'm calcifying my pineal gland or something
yeah,
like that. But yeah, it's not bad. So this Entheon, basically, they're letting you infuse DMT. So rather than getting that blast off to the universe type of inhalation that a lot of people experience and often freak out during, you're getting a lot of those same type of benefits, but with a slow infusion.
It's like the parallel or the analogy is psycholytic therapy versus psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. So these are the two core ways that psychedelics have been used in a therapeutic modality. Psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is the typical, you know, the thing that Johns Hopkins and NYU have studied, which is high dose of psilocybin, mystical experience, and the stronger the mystical experience is, the more profound healing someone has for depression, addiction, these other things. The psycholytic is more like a mini dose level where the ego is still present, but it's relaxed. It's not near as rigid. And so you can do actually therapeutic sessions while you're on the DMT. You're not just totally in another
right.
space. Right. And
right.
so I think the balance between those two, the psycholytic is much less intense and probably better for someone who's overly neurotic or doesn't have a lot of prior experience with psychedelics. Whereas the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is great for people who have significant deep issues that need to be worked through, and it can often accelerate that path really mm-hmm. quickly because the experiences are so intense.
Yeah. I want to ask you something about this whole idea of the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, because I often wonder how much of it is the psychedelic or the substance or the medicine, and how much of it is the integration. And what I mean by that is, when someone goes through a process like this, especially if they're using, let's say you're using a drug, right, to fix a problem that you have, the mere nature of the fact that you're going to a clinic, working with a professional, have taken this huge leap into the unknown to perhaps use some substance that you've never used before to go after some problem or addiction that you're experiencing. And then if you're in the right type of program, engaging in often weeks of therapy and talk therapy, and sometimes weeks going in beforehand, dictates that there's a lot going on in addition to the drug or the psychedelic, both psychologically and logistically, throughout this entire process. When I interviewed Dr. Matthew Johnson about the extremely successful nicotine addiction and nicotine withdrawal program that they did using their psilocybin-assisted therapy at Johns Hopkins, he sent me the entire package that every participant had to go through. I have it all printed off down in my office. And it's extensive. It's like aromatherapy and logging and journaling and multi-hour meetings with a therapist. And yeah, there's also psilocybin. But I've sometimes wondered, and I wish there were more control trials where they say, okay, we're going to do all this shit, but without the psychedelic, without the drug. And, you know, I'm just curious, you know, how much of it actually is the psychedelic. I question that sometimes.
I mean, it's a significant portion, especially now that this is sort of a new substance, a new way of looking at things, and what MDMA can do, for example, with the amygdala in terms of helping to mitigate its fear response allows for those people who struggle with PTSD to be able to have this catharsis of the trauma that happened. So there's definitely an element of the psychedelic plays a key and central role in accelerating that process. And there's no doubt that the support before and after, particularly after, plays a really critical role to help ensure that people can integrate those experiences. So it's not just another drug experience that you're having, but it's something that becomes solidified and part of your, you know, new self or whatever it might be.
That's the hardest part for me, is explaining this to people who are kind of stuck in almost like that first wave or second wave phenomenon of, I guess it would be second wave, of vilifying a lot of these things because they do view it as just doing substances or doing drugs and not doing the work or using the drug as a crutch or yet another addiction to replace an addiction that you've had. It's almost like my gut response is always like, don't knock it till you've tried it, bro. I mean, really, until you've been in that altered state of consciousness and combined it in a responsible set and setting with the type of integration that's necessary afterwards, until you've replaced that association that you have of cannabis being like a high school parking lot, taking a hit on a joint with, like, let's say, a microdose to enhance creativity for the day, or a couple of hits on a vape pen prior to sacred sex with your lover. I mean, like, it's just this idea that when I try to explain that to people, especially people who like grew up in the 60s or who have had bad experiences with these type of drugs using an improper set and setting, it's like, it's so difficult to explain. You know, it's almost like the people who have done ayahuasca and come back with all this wonderful ideas, but they just like vomit it all over their whole family, have no idea, and just can't understand, and almost like winds up driving them farther away from their family than closer because the other people just don't get the experience. You know, it's been problematic for me personally, just trying to explain to people who don't get it, but also have no interest in even trying or using it because of the fear that they associate with it or the irresponsibility that they associate with it.
One, I think that speaks to, like, people just need to come into this in their own time, right? You don't want to, like, have to pull anyone or overly evangelize people to come into this, because these experiences are so profound and often so challenging and difficult, right? It takes a lot of courage to go into your deepest sense of self, to face a lot of the things that you hadn't previously faced. In fact, they did research at Imperial College that showed exactly this, that they compared typical antidepressants to psychedelics. And what antidepressants do is they activate the 5-HT1A receptor in the brain, which essentially numbs you to things which can be helpful in the short term, but clearly not in the long term. Whereas what psychedelics do is, because they activate the 5-HT2A receptor, it actually is a catharsis. It forces you to go into your subconscious and unconscious to
face that trauma or that difficult experience that you had that's informing your behavior without your knowledge. And in facing that and going into that and having that catharsis, that's how you actually heal it. Mm. Right? It's like you got to face the dragon to get the gold.
Yeah.
So you got to really, really sort of go into these deep parts of yourself, the shadow, the filth, if you will. And that, it's not for everyone. Back to what we said before, right? Like, this is certainly not for everyone. It requires courage. It requires a really strong reason and belief into how this can help. And then if you have that courage and that ability to go there, and you have the support, the prep, and the integration, then it can be incredibly healing and incredibly beneficial. So it's, and this again gets back into our conversation, right? Like, not doing psychedelics at all, I don't think that's necessarily great, but also doing psychedelics too often can be disassociative. You kind of have to find that middle way
right. In
working with psychedelics and thread right. That needle to ensure that they become responsibly integrated. And you're not just dismissing them, but you're also not overly reliant on them. You're able to integrate those experiences and move forward with them as a tool in the toolkit, but not being dependent on that tool.
And you're like, you're with Third Wave, you're training, are you training facilitators? Like, you have some kind of program where you're like training people or training coaches to actually walk people through this kind of stuff?
So a lot of the programs that are now rolling out in the psychedelic space are specifically for the clinical use of psychedelics, right? Because of all the research that's coming out, psilocybin for major depressive disorder, MDMA for PTSD, you know, MAPS has their own training program for clinicians, Synthesis rolled out a training program. There are several others because we have to train thousands, tens of thousands of clinicians in how to work with these substances in the next 3 to 5 to 7 years as this becomes approved by the FDA. And so that's a very clinical model. We're helping people with depression, addiction, things like that. With Third Wave and the program that we've rolled out, there's clearly a lot of use cases for clinical, but there's a lot of non-clinicians, executive coaches, wellness coaches, life coaches, even medical doctors, counselors, therapists, who are not necessarily focused on a healing perspective, but are looking at sort of a mind expansion or human potential, right? How can people integrate these substances to become their best selves, to reach self-actualization, to reach their greatest potential? And so what we're bringing folks through
to run a marathon faster. That's actually what Jim Fadiman told me. He was talking about microdosing with LSD and how some dude like increases marathon performance by like 20%.
Which is great, right?
Yeah.
These are tools for everything. And so what we're training coaches in is the non-clinical use of psychedelics.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily... A lot of these folks already facilitate, but we're not necessarily focused explicitly on facilitation. It's much more the general context of psychedelic substances, how you prepare, how you integrate, what's the usefulness for leadership, for flow, for optimal wellness, how do we set up ritual, how do we set up, you know, an experience and a container that we bring clients through. How do you even communicate to clients that this is something that you're aware of, that this is something that you're skilled in, that you're trained in?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're rolling out the first cohort in like July 9th. So it's very soon.
And these are called like Third Wave coaches.
Yeah. And then what we're building for Third Wave in the back end of that is a directory. So right now on Third Wave, we have the guides,
coach
the podcast. It's a coach directory. It's basically a provider directory. We have coaches, we have clinicians, we have retreats, and we have clinics. And we're rolling out that directory as sort of like the best of the best. If you're going to have a psychedelic experience, here's an individual, a coach or a clinician that you can work with. Here's a retreat that you can go to. Here's a clinic that you should go to. So we're partnering with
that have been vetted and trained by going through your guys's
process.
Okay.
Some of them, like the coaches themselves. Yeah. So the people who then go through our program, not only are we providing the training for them, but we're also providing some of the marketing about, okay, now that you've gone through this, how can you communicate to the public that
right.
you are trained in working with
right.
these really, really powerful
yeah.
tools.
Yeah, that's actually, it's kind of similar to what I did with the Ben Greenfield coaching program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, different, you know, not plant medicines, but we're more like, you know, hormones and endocrine system and you know, gut and brain function. But then also what we do is like a coach directory. We have a coach mm-hmm. liaison who connects the different clients that come to a coach that's going to be appropriate for them.
Precisely.
And then, you know, the coaches are typically all required to be a personal trainer or a nutritionist or a registered dietitian or a physician, but then we dress up their knowledge with a working knowledge of basically, you know, everything I've gotten boundless and, you know, just like my whole flavor of training and coaching and advising. And it sounds like you're kind of doing something similar, but in the plant medicine sector. So I could say, okay, well, if I really want to work with a coach who I know has been trained using a lot of Paul's ways and some of what you see when you go to the Third Wave website. I can just go to this Third Wave coach directory
and find a coach.
And then similarly, let's say I've got like somebody listening who's a personal trainer or a physical therapist, and they want to amp up their resume to be able to not only coach people for fat loss, but also, you know, be able to give people a working knowledge of how to microdose effectively for productivity. They could also go through a cert like that.
Yeah. And so that's what we cover. We cover microdosing. We also cover higher doses, and then we're covering like non-psychedelic modalities, breathwork, meditation, diet, sleep, leadership, all these things that support the experiences that we have when we're microdosing, when we're on higher doses, right? Okay. And we're saying, hey, like you're a coach, you have all of these tools that you're using as part of your toolkit. Psychedelics can be the most impactful one that you use to optimize client outcomes. Because so much of coaching is getting a clear sense of where the client wants to go, helping them to understand what objective they want to reach, and then guiding them through that path to reach that objective. And so if you have a tool like psychedelics that are shown through clinical research to improve, you know, neurobiology and to help with adaptability and to help with learning and to help with behavioral change, how can you then integrate them into your sort of protocol that you're using with the client, in addition to other things, to optimize those outcomes? And of course, because they're accelerants, you need a container, you need to be trained in it. And this gets back to what we talk about with what is the third wave? Well, it's the responsible and intentional use of psychedelics. And if we want to avoid the same mistakes of the second wave, then we essentially need to train an entire like professional network of folks who can work with these substances in a really profound and meaningful way.
I'm looking at this other thing you have on your microdosing course. Mm-hmm. Is this for coaches, or is this one for just like
that's more the general public? So we've had that for about 4 years, and we've said, hey, you know, we were talking a lot about microdosing, and microdosing is not just simply, you know, you take a little bit of LSD twice a week and see what happens. There's so much more around the microdosing itself.
I'm reading that it says the science behind microdosing, the shifting legal landscape, the wide world of microdosing applications and benefits, how to dial in your optimal state of being, preparing for liftoff, getting started with microdosing, your microdosing experience, your first month of microdosing, integration in daily life, and then macrodosing bonus module. Looks like much like videos and tracking templates. So this would be for somebody who's not necessarily a coach, but just like somebody who wants to just like learn everything there is to know about microdosing.
We have a lot of coaches and therapists and doctors and other professional psychiatrists who enroll in that because they're having clients come to them who are interested in microdosing. But it's also for, you know, like an enthusiast who has heard about microdosing and has heard about the benefits of it. Maybe they've tried microdosing once, but they didn't see a lot of outcomes from it. And they're like, okay, I really want to dial this in. How can I make sure that I'm as dialed in as possible with this tool? And so that's what that course is specifically for. Again, teaching that skill of microdosing, how we calibrate the dose levels, what different substances we use, what intentions we go in with that, what are other supporting modalities that can help to nourish us while we're going through a microdosing protocol. All those sorts of things are included in that.
10-day money back guarantee. Okay, look at that. Did you learn how to make a carrot cake smoothie?
Have I learned?
No, do you learn during that course?
Well, we can add that. We'll add that as a bonus
module. We'll do a video tomorrow morning. Dude, you got so much going on here. I mean, this website's really cool, and I'm going to link to it in the show notes, and I'll link to this coaching cert too, and also this microdosing course. What do you guys, you give me a discount code. Is it $10, 10% discount code?
For the certification program, there's a 10% discount for anyone who just comes through.
Ben Greenfield?
Yep. And I think for the microdosing course, I'll double check on that, but it's at least 10%.
I know we got kind of, I don't know, our teams do all sorts of stuff.
We'll figure that out in the show notes.
We're just supposed to sit around and like,
talk about
get in the cold pool and drink Zevia and play Frisbee golf. We'll everybody else go behind the scenes. But what I will do for all you listening in, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Paul Austin. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/Paul Austin, just like it sounds. I'll link to Paul's Third Wave website and also this synthesis retreat that he's created over in Amsterdam. But then I'll link to all these coaching certs and also some of the other podcasts that we talked about, like my podcast with Jamie Wheel and with Jim Fadiman. And Paul's actually got a book called Microdosing Psychedelics. I know you're working on a new book now. And dude, I really love the stuff you're putting out, and I think it's super helpful. And I also, the reason I wanted to interview you was because there's just a lot of crap out there, and because I eat my own dog food, like we were talking about before, like why we don't do a video podcast. I'm like, I don't really watch video podcasts. I listen to podcasts, so that's mostly what I do. Same thing, like I'd love to open people up to the same type of advice that I rely upon for my own microdosing protocols and what I've learned. And your website's like way up there as far as like one of the best resources, I think. So
thank you.
So good on you, as they say down under. And I guess at this point we have to gear up for me to kick your ass in frisbee golf.
Oh, is that what we're doing?
I think frisbee golf is going to happen. For those of you listening in, again, bengreenfieldfitness.com/PaulAustin is where you can learn more about Paul and check out his course. Check out this microdosing course for your coach. Check out the microdosing third wave coaching certification, I guess, microdosing and macrodosing. Mm-hmm. Third wave coach certification. I'll link to all that. And Paul, dude, give me a cheers with the Zevia.
Cheers.
Cling, cling.
This is great.
Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for visiting Spokompton.
Oh, yeah. It was tons of fun.
All right, folks. I'm Ben Greenfield along with Paul Austin. Have an amazing week.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.